"They will all be coming to me one day, I suppose," the ambassador said. "But misery likes company."
"A terrible thing happened this morning, Excellency. They stopped Dr. Philippa's funeral and stole the coffin."
"I heard rumors. I didn't believe them."
"They are true enough," I said. "I was there. I saw the whole." "Monsieur Henri Philippot," the manservant announced, and a young man advanced towards us through the silence with a slight polio limp. I recognized him. He was the nephew of the ex-minister, and I had met him once before in happier days, one of a little group of writers and artists who used to gather at the Trianon. I remembered him reading aloud some poems of his own, well-phrased, melodious, a little decadent and vieux jeu, with echoes of Baudelaire. How far away those times seemed now! All that was left to recall them were the rum punches of Joseph.
"Your first refugee, Excellency," Hamid said. "I was half expecting you, Monsieur Philippot."
"Oh, no," the young man said. "Not that. Not yet. I understand when you claim asylum, you have to make a promise not to indulge in political action."
"What political action are you proposing to take?" I asked.
"I am melting down some old family silver."
"I don't understand," the ambassador said. "Have one of my cigars, Henri. They are real Havana."
"My dear and beautiful aunt talks about a silver bullet, but one bullet might go astray. I think we need quite a number of them. Besides, we have to deal with three devils, not one. Papa Doc, the head of the Tonton Macoute, and the colonel of the palace guard."
"It's a good thing," the ambassador said, "that they bought arms and not microphones with American aid."
"Where were you this morning?" I asked. "I arrived from Cap Haïtien too late for the funeral. Perhaps it was a lucky thing. I was stopped at every barrier on the road. I think they thought my Land Rover was the first tank of an invading army."
"How is everything up there?"
"Only too quiet. The place swarms with the Tonton Macoute. Judging by the sunglasses, you might be in Beverly Hills." Martha came in while he spoke, and I was angry when she looked first at him, though I knew it was prudent to ignore me. She greeted him a shade too warmly, it seemed to me.
"Henri," she said, "I'm so glad you're here. I was afraid for you. Stay with us for a few days."
"I must stay with my aunt, Martha."
"Bring her, too, and the child."
"The time hasn't come for that."
"Don't leave it too late."
She turned to me with a pretty meaningless smile, which she kept in store for second secretaries, and said, "We are a third-rate embassy, aren't we, until we have a few refugees of our own?"
"How is your boy?" I asked. I meant the question to be as meaningless as her smile.
"The pain is better now. He wants very much to see you."
"Why should he want that?"
"He always likes to see our friends. Otherwise, he feels left out."
Henri Philippot said, "If only we had white mercenaries as Dushombe had. We Haitians haven't fought for 40 years, except with knives and broken bottles. We need a few men of guerrilla experience. We have mountains just as high as those in Cuba."
"But not the forests," I said, "to hide in. Your peasants have destroyed those."
"We held out a long time against the American Marines all the same," he added bitterly. "I say we, but I belong to a later generation. In my generation we have learnt to paint. You know they buy Benoit's pictures now for the Museum of Modern Art. Of course they cost far less than a European primitive. Our novelists are published in Paris, and now they live there too."
"And your poems?"
"They were quite melodious, weren't they? But they sang the doctor into power. All our negatives made that one great black positive. I even voted for him. Do you know that I haven't an idea how to use a Bren? Do you know how to use a Bren? It's an easy weapon you could learn in 5 minutes. Then teach me with diagrams and empty matchboxes, and perhaps one day I'll find the Bren. I know someone better equipped than I am as a teacher, but he's in prison at the moment. I told him about Major Jones. So they beat him up? He asked with satisfaction. Yes. That's good. White men react badly to a beating up. He seemed to take it very easily. I almost had the impression he was used to it. You think he has some real experience? He told me he had fought in Burma, but I've only got his word for that. And you don't believe it? There's something about him I don't believe, not altogether. I was reminded when I talked to him of a time when I was young, and I persuaded a London restaurant to take me on because I could talk French. I said I'd been a waiter at Fouquet's. I was expecting all the time that someone would call my bluff, but no one did. I made a quick sale of myself, like a reject with the price label stuck over the floor. And again, not so long ago, I sold myself just as successfully as an art expert. No one called my bluff then, either. I wonder sometimes whether Jones isn't playing the same game. I remember looking at him one night on the boat from America, it was after the ship's concert, and wondering, are you and I both comedians? They can say that of most of us. Wasn't I a comedian with my verses smelling of Les Fleurs du Mal, published on handmade paper at my own expense? I posted them to the leading French reviews. That was a mistake. My bluff was called. I never read a single criticism, except by Petit Pierre. This same money would have bought me a Bren, perhaps. It was a magic word to him, Bren. The ambassador said, Come on, cheer up, let us all be comedians together. Take one of my cigars, help yourself at the bar. My scotch is good. Perhaps even Papa Doc is a comedian. Oh, no, Filippo said. He is real. Horror is always real. The ambassador said, We mustn't complain too much of being comedians. It's an honorable profession. If only we could be good ones, the world might gain at least a sense of style. We have failed, that's all. We are bad comedians. We aren't bad men. For Christ's sake, Martha said in English, as though she were addressing me directly. I'm no comedian. We had forgotten her. She beat with her hands on the back of the sofa and cried to them in French now. You talk so much, such rubbish. My child vomited just now. You can smell it still on my hands. He was crying with pain. You talk about acting parts. I'm not acting any part. I do something. I fetch a basin. I fetch aspirin. I wipe his mouth. I take him into my bed. She began to weep, standing behind the sofa. My dear, the ambassador said with embarrassment. I couldn't even go to her or look at her too closely. Hamid watched me, ironic and comprehending. I remembered the stains we had left on his sheets, and I wondered whether he had changed them himself. He knew as many intimate things as a prostitute's dog. You put us all to shame, Filippo said. She turned and left us, but her heel came off on the edge of the carpet, and she stumbled and nearly fell in the doorway. I followed her and put my hand under her elbow. I knew that Hamit was watching me, but the ambassador, if he noticed anything, covered up well. Tell Angel I'll be up in half an hour to say good night. I closed the door behind me. She had taken off her shoe and was struggling to fasten the heel. I took it from her. There's nothing we can do, I said. Haven't you another pair?
I've 20 other pairs. Does he know, do you think?
Perhaps. I don't know.
Will that make it any easier?
I don't know.
Perhaps we won't have to be comedians any more.
You said you were no comedian.
I exaggerated, didn't I? But all that talk irritated me. It made every one of us seem cheap and useless and self-pitying. Perhaps we are, but we needn't revel in it. At least I do things, don't I, even if they are bad things. I didn't pretend not to want you. I didn't pretend I loved you that first evening.
Do you love me?
I love Angel, she said defensively, walking up the wide Victorian staircase in her stockinged feet. We came to a long passage lined with numbered rooms.
You've got plenty of rooms for refugees.
Yes.
Find a room for us now.
It's too risky.
It's as safe as the car, and what does it matter if he knows?
In my own house, he would say, just as you would say, in our Peugeot. Men always measure betrayal in degrees. You wouldn't mind so much, would you, if it was someone else's Cadillac?
We're wasting time. He gave us half an hour.
You said you'd see Angel.
Then afterwards?
Perhaps. I don't know. Let me think.
She opened the third door down, and I found myself where I never wanted to be, in the bedroom she shared with her husband. The two beds were both double beds. Their rose-colored sheets seemed to fill the room like a carpet. There was a tall pier glass in which he could watch her prepare for bed. Now I had begun to feel a liking for the man. I saw no reason why Martha should not like him too. He was fat, but there are women who love fat men, as they love hunchbacks or the one-legged. He was possessive, but there are women who enjoy slavery. Angel sat upright against two pink pillows. The mumps had not noticeably increased the fatness of his face. I said, "Hi." I don't know how to talk to children. He had brown, expressionless Latin eyes like his father, not the blue Saxon eyes of the hanged man. Martha had those.
"I am ill," he said in a tone of moral superiority.
"So I see.
I sleep here with my mother. My father sleeps in the dressing room until the fever has gone. I have a temperature of..."
I said, "What's that you're playing with?"
"A puzzle." He said to Martha, "Is there no one else downstairs?" "Monsieur Hamid is there, and Henri. I would like them to come and see me, too." "Perhaps they have never had mumps. They might be afraid of catching it." "Has Monsieur Brown had mumps?"
Martha hesitated, and he took note of her hesitation, like a cross-examining counsel. I said, "Yes."
"Does Monsieur Brown play cards?" he asked with apparent irrelevance. "No, that is, I don't know," she said, as though she feared a trap.
"I don't like cards," I said.
"My mother used to. She went out nearly every night playing cards, before you went away." "We have to go now," Martha said. "Papa will be up in half an hour to say good night."
He held out the puzzle to me and said, "Do this." It was one of those little rectangular boxes with glass sides that contain a picture of a clown and two sockets where his eyes should be, and two little beads of steel which have to be shaken into the holes. I turned it this way and that way. I would get one bead in place, and then, in trying to fix the other, I would dislodge the first. The child watched me with scorn and dislike. "I'm sorry. I'm no good at this sort of thing. I can't do it."
"You aren't properly trying," he said. "Go on."
I could feel the time I had left to be alone with Martha disappearing like sand in an egg timer, and I could almost believe that he could see it too. The devilish beads chased each other round the edge of the box and ran across the eye sockets without falling in. They took dives into corners. I would get them moving slowly downhill towards the sockets on a low gradient, and then, with the slightest tilt to guide them, they plunged to the bottom of the box. All had to be begun again. I hardly moved the box at all now, except by a quiver of my nerves. I've got one in.
That's not enough, he said implacably.
I flung the box back at him. All right, you show me. He gave me a treacherous, unfriendly grin. He picked the box up, and holding it over his left hand, he hardly seemed to move it at all. One bead even mounted against the slope, tarried on the edge of a socket, and fell in.
One, he said.
The other bead moved straight for the other eye, shaved the socket, turned, and dropped into the hole.
Two, he said.
What's that in your left hand?
Nothing.
Then show me nothing. He opened his fist and showed a small magnet concealed there.
Promise you won't tell, he said.
And what if I won't? We might have been adults quarreling over a trick at cards. He said,
I can keep secrets if you can.
His brown eyes gave nothing away. I promise, I said. Martha kissed him and smoothed his pillows and laid him flat and turned on a small nightlamp beside his bed.
Will you come to bed soon? He asked.
When my guests have gone.
When will that be?
How can I tell?
You can always say that I'm ill. I may vomit again. The aspirin isn't working. I'm in pain.
Just lie still. Close your eyes. Papa will be up soon. Then I expect they will all go away, and I will come to bed.
You haven't said good night, he accused me.
Good night. I put a false friendly hand on his head and ruffled his tough dry hair. My hand smelt afterwards like a mouse. In the corridor, I said to Martha, Even he seems to know.
How can he possibly?
It's a game all children play. But how difficult it was to consider him a child.
She said, He has suffered a great deal of pain. Don't you think he's behaving very well?
Yes, of course, very well.
Quite like a grown-up?
Oh, yes, I thought that myself. I took her wrist and drew her down the corridor. Who sleeps in this room?
No one.
I opened the door and pulled her in. Martha said,
No, can't you see it's impossible?
I've been away 3 months, and we've made love only once since then.
I didn't make you go away to New York. Can't you feel I'm not in the mood? Not tonight?
You asked me to come tonight.
I wanted to see you, that's all. Not to make love.
You don't love me, do you?
You shouldn't ask questions like that.
Why?
Because I might ask you the same.
I recognized the justness of her retort, and it angered me, and the anger drove away the desire. How many adventures have you had in your life?
4,
she said, with no hesitation at all. And I'm the 4th.
Yes, if you want to call yourself an adventure.
Many months later, when the affair was over, I realized and appreciated her directness. She played no part. She answered exactly what I asked. She never claimed to like a thing that she disliked, or to love something to which she was indifferent. If I had failed to understand her, it was because I failed to ask her the right questions, that was all. It was true that she was no comedian. She had kept the virtue of innocence, and I know now why I loved her. In the end, the only quality but beauty which attracts me in a woman is that vague thing, goodness. The woman in Monte Carlo had betrayed her husband with a schoolboy, but her motive had been generous. Martha, too, had betrayed her husband, but it was not Martha's love for me which held me, if she did love. It was her blind, unselfish attachment to her child. With goodness, one can feel secure. Why wasn't I satisfied with goodness? Why did I always ask her the wrong questions? Why not one adventure to last? I asked as I released her.
How can I tell?
I remember the only real letter which I had ever received from her, apart from notes for rendezvous, made ambiguous in case they fell into the wrong hands. It was while I was waiting in New York, and I must have written to her grudgingly, suspiciously, jealously. I had found a call girl on East 56th Street, and so I assumed, of course, that she had found an equivalent resource to fill the empty months. She wrote back to me with tenderness, without rancor. Perhaps having one's father hanged for monstrous crimes puts all our petty grievances into proportion. She wrote of Angel and his cleverness in mathematics. She wrote a great deal about Angel and the nightmares he was having. I stay in with him nearly every night now. And at once I began to wonder what she did when she did not stay in, with whom she passed the evening hours. It was useless to tell myself that she was with her husband or at the casino where I had first met her. And suddenly, as though she knew how my thoughts would turn, she wrote, or words to that effect, "Perhaps the sexual life is the great test. If we can survive it with charity to those we love and with affection to those we have betrayed, we needn't worry so much about the good and the bad in us. But jealousy, distrust, cruelty, revenge, recrimination, then we fail. The wrong is in that failure, even if we are the victims and not the executioners. Virtue is no excuse." At that moment I found in what she wrote a pretentiousness, a lack of sincerity. I was angry with myself, and so I was angry with her. I tore the letter up in spite of its tenderness, in spite of the fact that it was the only one I had. I thought she was preaching at me because I had spent 2 hours that afternoon in the apartment on East 56th Street, though how could she possibly have known? That is the reason why, of all my jackdaw relics, the paperweight from Miami, an entrance ticket from Monte Carlo, I have no scrap of her writing with me now. And yet I can remember her writing very clearly, rounded and childish, though I can't remember the tones of her voice. "Well," I said, "we may as well go downstairs." The room we stood in was cold and unoccupied. The pictures on the wall were probably chosen by an office of works.
"You go. I don't want to see those people."
"The Columbus statue when he's better?"
"The Columbus statue."
Just as I was expecting nothing, she put her arms round me. She said,
"Poor darling, what a homecoming."
"It's not your fault."
She said, "Let's do it. Let's do it quickly."
She lay on the edge of the bed and pulled me towards her, and I heard the voice of Angel down the passage calling,
"Papa! Papa!"
"Don't listen," she said. She had drawn up her knees, and I was reminded of Dr. Filippo's body under the diving board. Birth, love, and death, in their positions, closely resemble each other. I found I could do nothing, nothing at all. No white bird flew in to save my pride. Instead, there were the footsteps of the ambassador mounting the stairs.
"Don't worry," she said. "He won't come here."
But it wasn't the ambassador who had chilled me. I stood up, and she said,
"It doesn't matter. It was a bad idea of mine, that's all."
"The Columbus statue?"
"No, I'll find something better. I swear I will."
She went out of the room in front of me and called,
"Louise?"
"Yes, dear." He came to the door of their room, carrying Angel's puzzle.
"I'm just showing Mr. Brown the rooms up here. He says we could do with a few refugees."
There was not a false note in her voice. She was perfectly at ease, and I thought of her anger when we talked of comedians, although now she proved to be the best comedian of us all. I played my part less well. There was a dryness in my voice which betrayed anxiety, and I said, "I must go."
"Why? It's still quite early," Martha said. "We haven't seen you for a long time, have we, Louise?"
"There's a rendezvous I have to keep," I told her without knowing that I spoke the truth. 3. The long day was not yet over. Midnight was an hour or an age away. I took my car and drove along the edge of the sea, the road pitted with holes. There were very few people about. Perhaps they had not realized the curfew was raised, or they feared a trap. On my right hand were a line of wooden huts in little fenced saucers of earth where a few palm trees grew, and slithers of water gleamed between, like scrap iron on a dump. An occasional candle burned over a little group, bowed above their rum like mourners over a coffin. Sometimes there were furtive sounds of music. An old man danced in the middle of the road. I had to brake my car to a standstill. He came and giggled at me through the glass. At least there was one man in Port-au-Prince that night who was not afraid. I couldn't make out the meaning of his patois, and I drove on. It was 2 years or more since I had been to Mayor Catherine's, but tonight I needed her services. My impotence lay in my body like a curse which it needed a witch to raise. I thought of the girl on East 56th Street, and when reluctantly I thought of Martha, I whipped up my anger. If she had made love to me when I had wanted her, this would not be happening. Just before Mayor Catherine's, the road branched. The tarmac, if you could call it tarmac, came to an abrupt end. Money had run out, or someone hadn't received his cut. To the left was the main southern highway, almost impassable except by jeep. I was surprised to find a roadblock there, for no one expected invasion from the south. I stood, while they searched me more carefully than usual, under a great placard which announced, USA-Haitian Joint 5-Year Plan, Great Southern Highway. But the Americans had left, and nothing remained of all the 5-year plan but the notice board over the stagnant pools, the channels in the road, the rocks, and the carcass of a dredger which nobody had bothered to rescue from the mud. After they let me go, I took the right fork and arrived at Mayor Catherine's compound. All was so quiet, I wondered whether it was worth my while to leave the car. A long, low hut, like a stable, divided into stalls, were the quarters here for love. I could see a light burning in the main building, where Mayor Catherine received her guests and served them drinks, but there was no sound of music and dancing. For a moment, fidelity became a temptation, and I wanted to drive away. But I had carried my malady too far along the rough road to be put off now, and I moved cautiously across the dark compound towards the light, hating myself all the way. I had foolishly turned the car against the wall of the hut so that I was in darkness, and almost at once I stumbled against a jeep standing lightless. A man slept at the wheel. Again I nearly turned and went, for there were few jeeps in Port-au-Prince which were not owned by the Tonton Macout, and if the Tonton Macout were making a night of it with Mayor Catherine's girls, there would be no room for outside custom. But I was obstinate in my self-hatred, and I went on. Mayor Catherine heard me stumbling and came to meet me on the threshold, holding up an oil lamp. She had the face of a kind nanny in a film of the Deep South, and a tiny, delicate body which must once have been beautiful. Her face didn't belie her nature, for she was the kindest woman I knew in Port-au-Prince. She pretended that her girls came from good families, that she was only helping them to earn a little pin money, and you could almost believe her, for she had taught them perfect manners in public. Till they reached the stalls, her customers, too, had to behave with decorum, and to watch the couples dance, you would almost have believed it to be an end-of-term celebration at a convent school. On one occasion, 3 years before, I had seen her go in to rescue a girl from some brutality. I was drinking a glass of rum, and I heard a scream from what we called the stable. But before I could decide what to do, Mayor Catherine had taken a hatchet from the kitchen and sailed out like the little Revenge, prepared to take on a fleet. Her opponent was armed with a knife. He was twice her size, and he was drunk with rum. He must have had a flask in his hip pocket, for Mayor Catherine would never have allowed him to go outside with a girl in that condition. He turned and fled at her approach, and later when I left, I saw her through the window of the kitchen, with the girl upon her knee, crooning to her as though she were a child, in a patois which I couldn't understand, and the girl slept against the little bony shoulder. Mayor Catherine whispered a warning to me. "The Tontons are here." "All the girls taken?" "No, but the girl you like is busy." I hadn't been here for 2 years, but she remembered, and what was even more remarkable, the girl was with her still. She would be close on 18 by now. I hadn't expected to find her, and yet I was disappointed. In age, one prefers old friends, even in a bordel. "Are they in a dangerous mood?" I asked her.
"I don't think so. They are looking after someone important. He's out with Tantan now."
I nearly went away, but my grudge against Martha worked like an infection. "I'll come in," I said. "I'm thirsty. Give me a rum and coke."
"There's no more coke."
I had forgotten that American aid was over. "Rum and soda, then."
"I have a few bottles of 7-Up left."
"All right, 7-Up. At the door of the salle, a tom-tom macoot was asleep on a chair. His sunglasses had fallen into his lap, and he looked quite harmless. The flies of his grey flannel trousers gaped from a lost button. Inside, there was complete silence. Through the open door, I saw a group of four girls dressed in white muslin with balloon skirts. They were sucking orangeade through straws, not speaking. One of them took her empty glass and moved away, walking beautifully, the muslin swaying like a little bronze by Degas. "No customers at all?"
"They all left when the Tonton Macoot came."
I went in, and there at a table by the wall, with his eyes fixed on me as though I had never once escaped from them, was the Tonton Macoot I had seen in the police station, who had smashed the windows of the hearse to get out the coffin of the Ancien Ministre. His soft hat lay on a chair, and he wore a striped bow tie. I bowed to him and started towards another table. I was scared of him, and I wondered whom it could be. More important than this arrogant officer, that Tantan was consoling now. I hoped for her sake he was not a worse man as well. The officer said, "I seem to see you everywhere." I try to be inconspicuous. "What do you want here tonight?"
"A rum and 7-Up.
He said to Mayor Catherine, who was bringing in my drink upon a tray,
"You said you had no 7-Up left."
I noticed that there was an empty soda water bottle on the tray beside my glass. The Tonton Macoute took my drink and tasted it.
7-Up it is. You can bring this man a rum and soda. We need all the 7-Up you have left for my friend when he returns."
"It's so dark in the bar. The bottles must have got mixed."
"You must learn to distinguish between your important customers and—"
he hesitated and decided to be reasonably polite.
"The less important." "You can sit down," he said to me.
I turned away.
"You can sit down here. Sit down."
I obeyed. He said,
"You were stopped at the crossroads and searched?"
"Yes."
"And at the door here? You were stopped at the door?"
"By Mayor Catherine, yes."
"By one of my men?"
"He was asleep."
"Asleep?"
"Yes." I had no hesitation in telling tales. Let the Tonton Macoute destroy themselves. I was surprised when he said nothing and made no move towards the door. He only stared blankly through me with his black opaque lenses. He had decided something, but he would not let me know his decision. Mayor Catherine brought me my drink. I tasted it. The rum was still mixed with 7-Up. She was a brave woman. I said,
"You seem to be taking a lot of precautions tonight." "I am in charge of a very important foreigner. I have to take precautions for his security. He asked to come here."
"Is he safe with little Tantan? Or do you keep a guard in the bedroom, Captain? Or is it Commandant?"
"My name is Captain Concasseur. You have a sense of humor. I appreciate humor. I am in favor of jokes. They have political value. Jokes are a release for the cowardly and the impotent."
"You said an important foreigner, Captain. This morning I had the impression that you didn't like foreigners."
"My personal view of every white man is very low. I admit I am offended by the color, which reminds me of turd. But we accept some of you, if you are useful to the state."
"You mean to the doctor?" With a very small inflection of irony, he quoted, "Je suis le drapeau haïtien, uni et indivisible." He took a drink of rum. "Of course, some white men are more tolerable than others. At least the French have a common culture with us. I admire the general. The president has written to him, offering to join La Communauté de l'Europe." "Has he received a reply?" "These things take time. There are conditions which we have to discuss. We understand diplomacy. We don't blunder like the Americans and the British." I was haunted by the name Concasseur. Somewhere I had heard it before. The first syllable suited him well, and perhaps the whole name, with its suggestion of destructive power, had been adopted like that of Stalin or Hitler. "Haiti belongs by right to any third force," Captain Concasseur said. "We are the true bastion against the communists. No Castro can succeed here. We have a loyal peasantry." "Or a terrified one." I took a long drink of rum. Drink helped to make his pretensions more supportable. "Your important visitor is taking his time." "He told me he had been away from women for a long time." He barked at Mayor Catherine. "I want service, service," and stamped the floor. "Why is no one dancing?" "A bastion of the free world," I said. The four girls rose from their table, and one put on the gramophone. They began to dance together in a graceful, slow, old-fashioned style. Their balloon skirts swung like silver censers and showed their slender legs the color of young deer. They smiled gently at each other and held one another a little apart. They were beautiful and undifferentiated, like birds of the same plumage. It was impossible to believe they were for sale, like everyone else. "Of course, the free world pays better," I said, "and in dollars." Captain Concasseur saw where I was looking. He missed nothing through those black glasses. He said, "I will treat you to a woman. That small girl there, with a flower in her hair, Louise. She doesn't look at us. She is shy because she thinks I might be jealous."
"Jealous of a putain? What absurdity. She will serve you very well if I give her the word."
"I don't want a woman." I could see through his apparent generosity. One flings a putain to a white man as one flings a bone to a dog.
"Then why are you here?"
He had a right to ask the question. I could only say, "I've changed my mind," as I watched the girls revolve, worthy of a better setting than the wooden shed, the rum bar, and the old advertisements for Coca-Cola. I said, "Are you never afraid of the communists?"
"Oh, there's no danger from them. The Americans would land marines if they ever became a danger. Of course, we have a few communists in Port-au-Prince. Their names are known. They are not dangerous. They meet in little study groups and read Marx. Are you a communist?"
"How could I be? I own the Hotel Trianon. I depend on American tourists. I am a capitalist."
"Then you count as one of us," he said, with the nearest he ever came to courtesy. "Except for your color, of course."
"Don't insult me too far."
"Oh, you cannot help your color," he said.
I meant, don't say I'm one of you. When a capitalist state gets too repulsive, it is in danger of losing the loyalty even of the capitalists.
A capitalist will always be loyal if he is allowed a cut of 25%.
A little humanity is necessary, too.
You speak like a Catholic.
Yes, perhaps. A Catholic who has lost his faith. But isn't there a danger that your capitalists may lose their faith, too?
They lose their lives, but never their faith. Their money is their faith. They guard it to the end and leave it to their children.
And this important man of yours, is he a loyal capitalist or a right-wing politician? While he chinked the ice in his glass, I thought I remembered where I had heard the name Captain Concasseur before. It was Petit Pierre who had spoken of him with some degree of awe. He had withdrawn all the dredges and pumps belonging to an American water company after the employees had been evacuated and the Americans had withdrawn their ambassador, and he had sent them to work on a wild project of his own at the mountain village of Kenskov. He hadn't got very far, for the laborers had left him at the end of a month because they were unpaid. It was said, too, that he hadn't cleared himself satisfactorily with the chief of the Tonton Macoute, who would have expected his proper cut. So Concasseur's Folly stood on the slopes of Kenskov, four cement columns and a cement floor already racking in the heat and the rains. Perhaps the important man now playing with Tintin in the stables was a financier who was going to help him out. But what financier, in his senses, would think of lending money in this country, from which all the tourists had fled, in order to build an ice-skating rink on the slopes of Kenskov? "We need technicians, even white technicians," Concasseur said. "The Emperor Christophe did without them. We're more modern than Christophe. An ice-skating rink instead of a castle?" "I think I have borne with you nearly enough," Captain Concasseur said, and I knew I had gone too far. I had touched his raw wound, and I was a little scared. If I had made love to Martha, what a different night this would have been. I would have been sleeping deeply in my own bed at the hotel, unconcerned with politics and the corruption of power. The captain took the revolver out of his holster and laid it on the table beside his empty glass. His chin dropped against his shirt of white and blue stripes. He sat in a lugubrious silence, as though he were weighing carefully the advantages and the disadvantages of a quick shot between the eyes. I could see no disadvantages, so far as he was concerned. Mayor Catherine came and stood behind me and deposited two glasses of rum. She said, "Your friend has been more than half an hour with Tintin. It is time."
"He must be allowed," the captain said, "whatever time he wants. He is an important man, a very important man."
Small bubbles of spittle gathered at the corners of his lips like venom. He touched the revolver with the tips of his fingers. He said, "An ice rink is very modern." His fingers played between the rum and the revolver. I was glad when he picked up the glass. He said, "An ice rink is chic. It is snob." Mayor Catherine said, "Your payment was for half an hour."
"My watch keeps a different time," the captain said. "You lose nothing. There are no other customers."
"There is Monsieur Brown."
"Not tonight," I said. I wouldn't know how to follow such an important guest.
"Then why are you staying here?" the captain asked.
"I'm thirsty and curious. It's not often in Haiti we have important visitors. Is he financing your ice rink?" The captain looked at his revolver, but the moment of spontaneity, which was the moment of real danger, had passed. Only signs of it remained, like traces of old sickness. The streak of blood across the yellow eyeballs, the striped tie which had somehow gone vertically askew. I said, "You wouldn't like your important foreign guest to come in and find a white corpse. It would be bad for business."
"That can always be arranged later," he said with somber truth. And then an extraordinary smile opened his face, like a crack in the cement of his own ice rink, a smile of civility, even of humility.
He stood up, and hearing the door of the salle close behind me, I turned and saw Tintin, all in white, smiling too, modestly, like a bride at a church door. But Concasseur and she were not smiling at each other. Both their smiles were directed at the guest of great importance on whose arm she had entered. It was Mr. Jones. 4.
"Jones!" I exclaimed.
There were still the relics of battle on his face, but they were neatly covered now with pieces of sticking plaster.
"Why, if it isn't Brown," he said. He came and shook my hand with great warmth. "It's good to see one of the old lot," he said, as though we were veterans at some regimental reunion who had not met since the last war but one.
"You saw me yesterday," I said, and I detected a slight embarrassment. When an unpleasantness was over, Jones forgot it as quickly as possible. He explained to Captain Concasseur, "Mr. Brown and I were shipmates on the Madeira. And how is Mr. Smith?" "Much as he was yesterday when he visited you, he has been anxious about you."
"About me? But why?" He said, "Forgive me, I haven't introduced my young friend here. Tantan and I know each other well." "That's fine, fine. Sit down, dear, and we'll all have a snifter." He pulled out a chair for her and then took my arm and led me a little aside. He said in a low voice, "You know, all that business is past history now." "I'm glad to see you safely out," he explained vaguely. "My note did it. I thought it would. I was never really worried. Mistakes on both sides. I wouldn't want the girls to know about it, though."
"You would find them very sympathetic. But doesn't he know?"
"Oh, yes, but he's bound to secrecy. I would have told you tomorrow how things had gone, but tonight I badly needed a roll in the hay. So you know Tantan?"
"Yes."
"She's a sweet girl. I'm glad I chose her. The captain wanted me to take that girl with the flower."
"I don't suppose you'd have noticed the difference. Mayor Catherine caters for a sweet tooth."
"What are you doing with him?"
"We're in a bit of business together."
"Not an ice rink?"
"No."
"Why an ice rink?"
"Be careful, Jones. He's dangerous."
"Don't worry about me," Jones said. "I know the world."
Mayor Catherine passed. Her tray was loaded with rum and what was probably the last of the 7-ups, and Jones grabbed a glass.
"Tomorrow they are finding me transport. I'll come and see you when I've got my car."
He waved to Tantan. To the captain he called, "Salute!"
"I like it here," he said. "I've landed on my feet."
I left the cell, my mouth cloyed with too much 7-up, and shook the sentry by the shoulder as I passed. I might as well do someone a good turn. I felt my way past the jeep to my own car, and heard footsteps behind me and dodged sideways. It might be the captain come to preserve the honour of his ice rink, but it was only Tantan.
She said, "I told them I go faire pipi."
"How are you, Tantan?"
"Very well. And you?"
"Somash."
"Why not stay a little while in your car? They will go soon. The Englishman is tout à fait épuisé."
"I don't doubt it, but I'm tired. I've got to go. Tantan, did he behave all right to you?"
"Oh, yes. I liked him. I liked him a lot."
"What did you like so much?"
"He made me laugh," she said.
It was a sentence which was to be repeated to me disquietingly in other circumstances. I had learned in a disorganized life many tricks, but not the trick of laughter. Part 2, Chapter 1. Jones fell from view for a while as completely as the body of the Secretary for Social Welfare. No one ever learnt what was done with his corpse, though the presidential candidate made more than one attempt to discover. He penetrated to the bureau of the new secretary, where he was received with celerity and politeness. Petitpierre had done his best to spread his fame as Truman's opponent, and the minister had heard of Truman. He was a small fat man who wore, for some reason, a fraternity pin, and his teeth were very big and white and separate, like tombstones designed for a much larger cemetery. A curious smell crossed his desk, as though one grave had stayed open. I accompanied Mr. Smith in case a translator were needed, but the new minister spoke good English with a slight twang, which went some way to support the fraternity pin. I learned later that he had served for a while as the small boy of the American embassy. It might have been a rare example of merit rising if he had not served an interim period in the Tonton Macoute, where he had been a special assistant to Colonel Garcia, known as Fat Garcia. Mr. Smith excused the fact that his letter of introduction was addressed to Dr. Filippo.
"Poor Filippo," the minister said, and I wondered whether at last we were to receive the official version of his end.
"What happened to him?" Mr. Smith asked with admirable directness.
"We will probably never know. He was a strange, moody man, and I must confess to you, Professor, his accounts were not in good order,
There was the matter of a water pump in Desay Street.
Are you suggesting he killed himself?
I had underrated Mr. Smith. In a good cause he could show cunning, and now he played his cards close to his chest.
Perhaps, or perhaps he has been the victim of the people's vengeance. We Haitians have a tradition of removing a tyrant in our own way, Professor.
Was Dr. Philipott a tyrant?
The people in Desay Street were sadly deceived about their water.
So the pump will be set working now? I asked.
It will be one of my first projects. He waved his hand at the files on the shelves behind him. But as you see, I have many cares. I noticed that the steel grips on many of his cares had been rusted by a long succession of rainy seasons. A care was not soon disposed of.
Mr. Smith came smartly back at him.
So Dr. Philipott is still missing?
As your war communiques used to put it, missing, believed, killed.
But I attended his funeral, Mr. Smith said.
His what?
His funeral.
I watched the minister. He showed no embarrassment. He gave a short bark, which was meant to be a laugh. I was reminded of a French bulldog, and said,
There was no funeral.
It was interrupted.
You cannot imagine, Professor, the unscrupulous propaganda put about by our opponents.
I am not a professor, and I saw the coffin with my own eyes.
That coffin was filled with stones, Professor. I'm sorry, Mr. Smith.
Stones?
Bricks, to be exact, brought from Duvalierville, where we are constructing our beautiful new city. Stolen bricks. I would like to show you Duvalierville one morning when you are free. It is our answer to Brasilia.
But his wife was there.
Poor woman, she was used, I hope innocently, by unscrupulous men. The morticians have been arrested.
I gave him full marks for readiness and imagination. Mr. Smith was temporarily silenced.
When are they to be tried? I asked.
The inquiries will take some time. The plot has many ramifications.
Then it's not true what the people think, that the body of Dr. Filippo is in the palace working as a zombie?
All that is voodoo stuff, Mr. Brown. Luckily, our president has rid the country of voodoo.
Then he has done more than the Jesuits could do.
Mr. Smith broke in with impatience. He had done his best in the cause of Dr. Filippo, and now it was his mission which demanded full attention. He was anxious not to antagonize the minister with such irrelevancies as zombies and voodoo. The minister listened to him with great courtesy, doodling at the same time with a pencil. Perhaps it was not a sign of inattention, for I noticed the doodle took the form of innumerable percentage marks and crosses. So far as I could see, there were no minus signs.
Mr. Smith spoke of a building which would contain a restaurant, kitchen, a library, and a lecture hall. If possible, there should be enough room for extensions. Even a theatre and cinema might be possible one day. Already his organization could supply documentary films, and he hoped that soon, given the opportunities for production, there might arise a school of vegetarian dramatists.
In the meanwhile, he said, we can always fall back on Bernard Shaw.
It is a great project, the minister said.
Mr. Smith had been in the Republic a week now. He had seen the kidnapping of Dr. Filippo's body. I had driven him through the worst of the shantytown. That morning he had insisted, against my advice, in going to the post office himself to buy stamps. I had lost him momentarily in the crowd, and when I found him again, he had not been able to approach a foot towards the guichet. Two one-armed men and the three one-legged men hemmed him round. Two were trying to sell him dirty old envelopes containing out-of-date Haitian postage stamps. The others were more frankly begging. A man without legs at all had installed himself between his knees and removed his shoelaces preparatory to cleaning his shoes.
Others, seeing a crowd collected, were fighting to join it.
A young fellow with a hole where his nose should have been lowered his head and tried to ram his way through towards the attraction at the center. A man with no hands raised his pink polished stumps over the heads of the crowd to exhibit his infirmity to the foreigner. It was a typical scene in the post office, except that foreigners were rare nowadays. I had to fight my way to reach him, and once my hand encountered a stiff, inhuman stump, like a piece of hard rubber. I forced it on one side, and I felt revolted by myself, as though I were rejecting misery. The thought even came to me, what would the fathers of the Visitation have said to me? So deeply embedded are the disciplines and myths of childhood. It took me 5 minutes to get Mr. Smith clear, and he had lost his shoelaces. We had to replace them at Hamid's before we called on the Secretary for Social Welfare. Mr. Smith said to the minister, "These centre, of course, would not be run at a profit, but I calculate we ought to give employment to a librarian, secretary, accountant, cook, waiters, and eventually, of course, the cinema usherettes, at least 20 people. The film shows would be educational and free of charge. As for the theatre, well, we mustn't look too far ahead. All vegetarian products would be supplied at cost price, and the literature for the library would be gratis." I listened to him with astonishment. The dream was intact. Reality could not touch him. Even the scene in the post office had not sullied his vision. The Haitians, freed from acidity, poverty, and passion, would soon be bent happily over their nut cutlets. "This new city of yours, Duvalierville," Mr. Smith said, "might provide an admirable situation. I'm not an opponent of modern architecture, not at all. New ideas need new shapes, and what I want to bring to your republic is a new idea." "It might be arranged," the minister said. "There are sites available." He was making a whole row of little crosses on his sheet, all plus signs. "You have plenty of funds, I'm sure." "I thought a mutual project with the government." "Of course, you realize, Mr. Smith, we are not a socialist state. We believe in free enterprise. The building would have to be put up to tender." "Fair enough." "Of course, the government would make the final decision between the tenders. It is not a mere matter of the lowest bid. There are the amenities of Duvalierville to be considered. And, of course, questions of sanitation are of first importance. For that reason, I think the project might well come in the first place under the Ministry for Social Welfare." "Fine," Mr. Smith said. "Then I would be dealing with you. Later, of course, we would have to have discussions with the Treasury and the Customs. Imports, of course, are the responsibility of the Customs." "Surely there are no duties here on food." "Films? Educational films?" "Oh, well, let us talk about all that later. There is first the question of the site and its cost." "Don't you think the government might be inclined to contribute the site, in view of our investment in labor? I guess land here doesn't fetch a high price anyway."
"The land belongs to the people, not the government, Mr. Smith," the minister said with gentle reproof. "All the same, you will find nothing is impossible in modern Haiti. I would myself suggest, if my opinion is asked, a contribution for the site equivalent to the cost of construction."
"But that's absurd," Mr. Smith said. "The two costs bear no relation."
"Returnable, of course, on completion of the work."
"So you mean the site would be free?"
"Quite free."
"Then I don't see the point of the contribution."
"To protect the workers, Mr. Smith. Many foreign projects have come suddenly to an end, and the worker on payday has found nothing in his envelope. A tragic thing for a poor family. We still have many poor families in Haiti."
"Perhaps a bank guarantee?"
"Cash is a better notion, Mr. Smith. The gourd has remained stable for a generation, but there are pressures on the dollar."
"I would have to write home to my committee, I doubt."
"Write home, Mr. Smith, and say that the government welcomes all progressive projects and will do all it can." He rose from behind his desk to signify that the interview was at an end, and his wide toothy smile showed that he expected it to be beneficial to all parties. He even put his arm around Mr. Smith's shoulders to demonstrate that they were partners in the great work of progress. "And the site?" "You will have a great choice of sites, Mr. Smith. Perhaps close to the cathedral, or the college, or the theatre. Anything which does not conflict with the amenities of Duvalierville. Such a beautiful city. You will see. I will show it to you myself. Tomorrow I am very busy. So many deputations. You know how it is in a democracy. But Thursday." In the car, Mr. Smith said, "He seemed interested, all right." "I would be careful about that contribution." "It's returnable." "Only when the building's completed." "His story about the bricks in the coffin, do you suppose there's something in that?"